CataractCoach.com podcast series, episode number 28 with Kathleen McCabe. Kathleen McCabe is an anterior segment surgeon specializing in cataract surgery, but also those complex anterior segment reconstruction cases. In particular, she developed the belt loop technique, which can be used to help resuspend and reposition dislocated IOLs of all designs. And we'll talk about that in the podcast. We talk about her leadership in ophthalmology, and we talk about other things that are coming down the road for you that you need to be aware of. We had a great discussion. I am sure you'll enjoy it. Check it out. I want to welcome you guys back to our Cataract Coach podcast. Today we have Kathleen McCabe. You've seen her videos here on Cataract Coach about the belt loop technique, a very innovative way to help fixate an IOL with an absence or weak capsular support. And that I thought was a genius idea. And she's also pioneered a lot of other things. She's an amazing surgeon. She is just nominated and has taken the position of this ASCRS secretary, which means in a couple of years she'll be the president. And she's certainly a leader in our field, and there's a lot we can learn from her. So welcome, Kathy, to our podcast. Pleasure to have you.
Well, I am so delighted to be here with you, the Cataract Coach. I just cannot believe your dedication to education and sharing all of the experience of so many people, but primarily yourself included there. So it's a thrill for me to be here with you.
Oh, thank you. You're too kind. Tell me about the belt loop technique, because that's the video of yours that we featured on Cataract Coach, and I'll put a link below so you can rewatch it for my audience members. But I thought it was so innovative, such a brilliant way of fixating an IOL with weak capsular support. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so, you know, it's one of those things where there was a problem. I realized that, you know, I was seeing patients who had intraocular lenses. A lot of times they were premium lenses, either a multifocal or a toric lens, that later dislocated in the bag. And as I was helping teach one of the Yamani technique courses, I realized that you could use that small segment of polypropylene suture and create a flange. And that really just got my brain working. I was like, you know I'm going to see one of these patients again. And when I do, I wonder if I can use that technology, that fact that polypropylene suture acts like a haptic on a CT Lucia lens, and instead refixate or center and support one of these premium IOLs that has dislocated in the bag. And a few months later, I had two really delightful ladies who each had a multifocal lens that had dislocated in the bag, and they really, really wanted to keep their lens. So I think The hard thing about coming up with something new is, how do you talk to a patient about the first time you're going to do a technique? And, you know, we want to be honest with our patients, and we want to tell them, you know, that this isn't something that we're absolutely certain is going to work for them. And so I think that was a little bit of the challenge for the first day. But thankfully, I had two patients on the same day. So it was an opportunity to really refine the technique.
How do you talk to a patient? What do you say? I mean, take us through it. Let's give me the pearls.
Yeah. So, I mean, fortunately for me, both of these ladies were really motivated to keep their lenses. And I talked to them about some of the things we would do in the past. You know, maybe we would use a smaller gauge polypropylene suture. That was a possibility. Or we do an IOL
like
exchange.
Like a 10-0 or a 9-0, right?
Right, yeah. So pretty much a 9-0, since we know that we could use a 9-0. We could tie it the way we normally tie suture, burying the knot. But we also know that over time, 9-0 and 10-0 polypropylene isn't all that strong and often breaks. And then we're stuck with having to figure out the solution again. So, and I told them about my experience, you know, using a larger gauge suture with this flange technique, and how we were using something similar with haptics, and that that actually would be my go-to to put a different lens in. Wouldn't be a multifocal lens, but I would use a similar technique if I were to take their current lens out and put a new lens in. But I said, I think I can use a similar principle for refixating the lens that you currently have. I've thought about it. I've tried this on a model eye, and I think it will work, but realize I will have, as I always do in these complex cases anyway, you know, plan B, plan C, plan D. And we may not be able to do it, but are you game for me to try to keep your lens? And they actually really wanted to keep their lens. So they were 100% on board. I was super psyched when it worked. They were super psyched that they got to be the beneficiary of that new technology and new technique, and it all worked out great.
Now, are you using 5-0 or 6-0 proline? What do you prefer?
So when I first did those couple of cases, the suture that we had used in the lab was 5-0 polypropylene. And so that's actually what I used. It's about the same gauge as a haptic on a C2 Lucia lens. And subsequently, now I use 6-0 polypropylene. It makes a smaller flange. And I think one of the key parts of that technique for long-term safety is being able to bury the flange through the superficial layers of the sclera.
Yes.
So, you know, I think the first time we try these flange techniques, our gut reaction is, boy, I don't want that to pull into the eye. So we really err on the side of making a large flange and saying, nope, that thing's not going anywhere. But the problem with that is it's hard to bury it in the superficial layers of the sclera, and the more likely long-term complication or the more worrisome one is that it may erode through conjunctiva and then expose, you know, that flange to the outside of the sealed conjunctiva, where now maybe bacteria can get into the eye and cause endophthalmitis. So because now I understand that dynamic a little bit better, I want to be sure critically that it actually is buried well. I have seen those early 5-0 polypropylene larger flanges that I made. I've seen one erode, was easy to fix, but I have never seen one pull inside.
Good point, and I agree with you completely. If you're going to do a flange technique, whether it's with this belt loop or whether it's a Cano Brava or whether it's a Yamane, to make sure that flange, that bulbous tip, is buried within the sclera and not just sitting subcons, where it's going to definitely erode through with time. It's only a question of time.
Yeah, I think the other key thing to tell patients, and I think it's one of the things that's probably precipitating some of these late dislocations, is really advising them not to touch or rub their eye. That rubbing their eye might have been part of the problem to begin with, and that with a suture there, no matter what your suture technique is, or, you know, even a Yamane technique as well, that rubbing your eye can lead to either re-dislocations or long-term complications, and that rubbing your eye is never a good idea.
Right, that's a great point. Now, you're still using the 30-gauge needles, the thin-wall needles for this?
So actually, with the 6-0 polypropylene suture, you can use a regular 30-gauge needle. You don't need to use the thin-wall needle. And I use a long needle. What I find to be, I think, a little more accessible to everybody, a little more stable, is to use that long needle, inch and a quarter, and externalize the needle through a paracentesis. It stabilizes the eye, and then you can approach putting the suture into the lumen of the needle with anything you like. You know, you can just use a tire or from any direction. You're not so limited like you are when you have to use intraocular forceps and just come through a paracentesis. So I've kind of, you know, now modified the technique a bit so that when I show videos, I think it's a little bit more accessible, a little more stable, a little bit easier for people to pick this up as a new technique.
Now, if a patient presents, let's say, in your clinic, you look at the patient with a slit lamp and you see some dislocation of the bag IOL complex, and it still seems like it's pretty much there. I mean, a pearl I've learned is, in the clinic, put the exam chair back, get him in a supine position, put the indirect on, not so much to examine the retina, but to just magnify and look and see how far into the mid-vitreous is that IOL sinking when the patient's supine. So if you have a patient 100%. With a lens that's kind of... Yeah, if the lens is kind of supine, well, how are you getting it back up? Are you, what kind of vitrectomy are you doing then? Kind of walk us through that.
Sure. So that's often a thing that we see. So number one, we see a patient in the clinic. Maybe it's dangling. I've seen so many different configurations. I'm sure you have too, where maybe you can barely see it, or you can only see the lens when they look down and they look up and it sort of floats up because it's hanging by maybe two or three little zonules or something. So sometimes it's hard to see the lens. Sometimes it looks like, hey, that's going to be no problem at all. It's sitting right behind the iris, just a little dislocated. But in that case, it may be just hanging by a few superior zonules. And as soon as you sit them back, it disappears. So really important tip that you just said about making sure you're prepared for what you might see intraocularly when you lay the patient back. And you can mimic that by doing just what you said, sitting them back in the chair and putting an indirect on. So sometimes you get fooled. I just had a patient this past week where I thought it was laying on the retina, pretty much to me looked like it was. But once we got in there, it was, and I did it actually with my retina specialist because I thought it was going to be all the way on the on the retina, but it was hanging by just a few little zonules, and I really was accessible anteriorly, and I could have probably just taken it myself. Now, in that case, it was a dislocated lens that the anterior capsulotomy was well-centered and intact, and it was actually a Cirque du Soleil performer who had had a large YAG, didn't have a lot of fibrosis there, and the lens had fallen posteriorly, but was still sort of hanging on just a little bit. Now, in that case, where their lens is really not within the capsular bag, you know, what we ended up doing is taking out that single piece acrylic lens, although I could have done a reverse optic capture. It was just a large anterior capsulotomy. That's why I didn't do that. And then I put a CT Lucia lens in the sulcus with optic capture, what I could manage of that. And that will, I think, be a long-term solution. But if for whatever reason he does some crazy acrobatics and it dislocates, I already have a lens in there that I can fixate with a flange technique and I won't have to take it out. So I think, you know, we're kind of thinking of the future with that solution to see how we could make a refixation, if needed, less complex.
Well, that begs the question then. So if we see patients who have, let's say, significant pseudoexfoliation, should we just primarily be putting in three-piece IOLs just to plan for that 10 or 15 or 18 years later dislocation?
So great idea, but what I tend to do, because we don't have three-piece IOL premium lenses, right? We don't really have a lot of torics that are three-piece. We don't have multifocal, trifocal, EDOF technologies in that format. So instead, with that same idea in mind, I put in a CTR, have kind of a low threshold for that. And part of it is because I just want more real estate if I need to do a belt loop in the future. If you have nice fibrosis of the anterior posterior capsule, you have a CTR in place, putting a belt loop around the haptic plus a CTR is a very, very stable situation in my mind. And I've had to do that before, and I feel very good about it when I have so much hardware in there to sort of keep the lens both planar, so it's not tilted, and centered really well and stably.
Now, you mentioned how there's obviously a benefit to having some degree of like fibrosis of the capsular bag as it shrink wraps down. Now, maybe it's just my mind playing tricks on me, but I think over the last few years where we really go really to an extreme almost with capsule polishing and have these pristine capsular bags, is that kind of leading to less fibrosis? And maybe even, is it somewhere on the spectrum of getting towards dead bag syndrome?
Okay, so great question. It's like one of those things, like, where are we on that, right? So, and I happen to be a pretty big advocate for polishing, at least some polishing of the anterior capsule. So I generally, what I call power wash the posterior capsule to make sure there's no little fibers of the cortex, at least centrally. And then I do use a curette to go around the anterior capsular leaflet, not out to the fornix, not under the iris, but just where I think that it will probably decrease the possibility of capsular phimosis. And so there's two competing thoughts in my mind. I want some peripheral adhesion, a little bit of fibrosis, because I think if they need a belt loop in the future, that gives you some substance. It stops the belt loop from migrating along the haptic as well. But I also do a fair number of IOL exchanges. And boy, when you have a lot of fibrosis in there, I think, gosh, if this person had only done a little bit better job of cleaning that up, it'd be easier for me to do my exchange. So I think there's two competing sort of thoughts there. So I try to somewhere skate in the middle of those. Now, the other thing is when you look at the data that's been compiled around dead bag syndrome, it's really the configuration of the peripheral bag and not the presence or absence of those lens epithelial cells that seem to be more associated with dead bag syndrome. So that question has been asked of Liliana Werner, who did a lot of that research. And she has not said that there's a correlation with how much polishing we're doing of the bag. So I kind of defer to the person who's been doing a lot of looking at these bags in the periphery. Sure. And if she says it's not related, then I think my skating in the middle is probably a good compromise.
Fantastic. So you must have done dozens of these belt loop procedures by now, if not even 100 or more, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I've done quite a few. Every lens configuration that I think exists, including crystallens, I've belt looped before. So you can do it in just about anything, you know, as long as you're really paying attention to making sure that you don't put any forces that will cause tilt, because that's the biggest thing. And then that you look at how the lens is elevating. That's the biggest thing I do as I'm adjusting both sides of the belt loop, because oftentimes you're putting one on each side 180 degrees apart. So you want to make sure you're lifting it enough that it has that normal configuration, the normal spacing behind the iris in a planar fashion.
Oh, so yeah, a little bit of time to keep it even also to avoid inducing any tilt, let's say, as well. So yeah, yes, little subtleties there. Very nice there. Now, in your practice, though, I'm sure your primary procedure, though, is probably cataract surgery, and you've done some unheard of number, I'm sure.
Well, I do primarily cataract surgery, thank goodness. Although, you know, when you start talking about complex surgeries, it seems like everybody in your area, because who wants to really, you know, just do a lot of complex surgeries, doesn't mind sending those to you. So you end up doing a little bit more, maybe, than I used to do. But I find them challenging and rewarding and a service to the patient. And we know financially, probably not much of a service to the practice, but really happy that I can help them. But yes, I want my practice to be primarily straightforward cataracts, for sure.
Cool. How did you get started in all this? Take us kind of through your path. And you obviously in med school liked ophthalmology, so you applied to ophthalmology. Where did you take it from there?
Yeah, so the kind of the funny thing about my path through med school even was, you know, in my medical school, I don't know about yours, Uday, but we didn't really have exposure to ophthalmology. It was a two-week computer program. We didn't even see patients. We didn't even see an ophthalmologist unless we did a specific elective. And in my case, my brother, my older brother by a year and a half, is an optometrist. And I had a little bit of a, you know, not direct route. I was marine biology undergrad, and then I went to graduate school in zoology, actually, and worked in a basic science lab for a little bit before I came to medical school. So we had a little gap there, and my brother kept telling me, you need to at least take an elective in ophthalmology. And I was like, no, eyes are your thing. I don't need to do anything in eyes. Eventually, though, he prevailed, and I did an elective following around, you know, and attending in retina. And I really loved retina. And so I went into ophthalmology really with the idea that I was going to be a retina specialist, and went to Bascom-Palmer and spent the entire time doing retina research, going to retina, you know, meetings, working with the retina specialist Tim Murray and Harry Flynn there. And thought that would be my path. It was really at the very last moment that I just thought about, you know, where that path was going to lead me and how much I loved cataract surgery and really loved the fact that we could restore patients' vision to better than they had before. And that's not necessarily true with retina surgery. You're taking a bad situation, you're making it better, but you're not doing something that's better than they had before typically. So I jumped ship, actually, sort of at the last minute, and decided to concentrate more on cataract and refractive.
Yeah, I did the same thing. When I started residency at UCLA, gosh, more than 25 years ago, I thought, yeah, I'll do retina. I loved retina, until I started doing cataract surgery. And then it was like incredibly fun. And also at the time, sometimes timing is everything. When I was a resident, in retina, they were doing macular translocation surgery, which didn't really pan out so well for macular degeneration. There was no OCT machine. There was no anti-VEGF machine injections. So it was just like, it was a different world. There was no small gauge of vitrectomy even. And so, you know, at the time, I just thought, huh.
I think you and I are contemporaries because, you know, really, it was just at the end of my residency. And it would have been at the beginning of my fellowship that any intravitreal injections really started. That was not on my radar. I did not know that was going to be the landscape in retina. I did think it would be, you know, complex and really interesting retinal surgeries that would test, you know, your surgical skill. But if I had known the landscape, I would have only been even more excited to do something that I felt, you know, was making that very short impact, very or very short surgery with very large life-changing impact. And I think the second part of that was that I had always been interested in global healthcare and missions. Mm-hmm. And, you know, really doing cataract surgery is a way to make a huge impact in a short period of time that really is life-changing when you travel outside the United States too. And that has been a part of my practice all along.
Yeah, I do the same thing. I haven't done one since COVID, but prior to that, just about every year I do a charity surgery mission trip where you do some phaco, but a lot of MSICS, manual small incision cataract surgery. And those patients are truly needing it. I mean, truly blinding cataracts. It's one of them, I think, my favorite modern miracle of medicine.
I totally agree. And it's like, to me, it's sort of re-energizing. You know, so much of what we do today, we are thinking about reimbursement or regulatory things or paperwork or prior authorizations or all of this other stuff. And it just takes all of that away. And it's so simple. A patient comes with a very severe problem that's life affecting. You see the problem, you have the solution, you provide the solution, they see the benefit. And like all the other stuff that goes on and that's frustrating, we don't have to deal with. We just go, problem, solution, yay, we can celebrate. And, you know, that is like reaffirming for why we do this to begin with. And it re-energizes me. And we've actually been doing this one mission that we do every year in St. Vincent for 20 years now. The first year I went was in 2003. And so this year in May, we went in our 20th, it's not exactly our 20th year going because we missed 2 years with COVID, but we've been back for 2 years now again. And it's been a passion project for us as a family as well, which has been really cool. And then next month I go to Kenya again for my third time, actually, yeah, in September. So in a couple weeks.
Wow. Fantastic. Yeah. For all our young audience members, our podcast has the full spectrum of age of ophthalmologists. So anywhere between like kind of late 20s to probably late 80s is our audience, but mostly 30 to 50. And for the young ophthalmologists, I certainly recommend sign up for one of these charity surgery trips. You will really enjoy it. And it will test your surgical skill because you'll have the toughest cases with the most basic of equipment.
But I think that, you know, it's so important. So I'm going to just second what you said, because I think what it does, and if you get involved early, you realize it's going to keep you nimble. It's going to keep you thinking outside the box and not afraid to get outside of your comfort zone. And I think that's one of the things that maybe slows down our evolution as surgeons, that we think, you know, I used to be nervous about this or that. Now I can, you know, think about other things unless there's something really unexpected happening during surgery. I don't want to go back to that feeling of being nervous or, you know, not being 100% comfortable. But it also freezes us a bit where we are in our surgical skills. And I think if you keep taking yourself outside of that comfort zone, which always missions do, even our mission we go on every year has a different challenge every year for sure. Then you keep nimble as a surgeon. You keep innovating as a surgeon. You keep thinking outside the box and being comfortable with being uncomfortable. And so those are key things to keep, you know, in your comfort level, in your skill set.
Sure.
Being nimble.
Yeah. Oh, I think that's fantastic advice. Yeah, you've got to keep pushing yourself surgically too, because as you've seen in your career and I've seen in mine over the years, you keep evolving. Things keep changing. The way we do surgery now is certainly not the way we did it in the past. And you got to be able to
teach yourself
this. Right? You know, we've come a long way. Yeah. And there's still so much yet to come. Speaking of which, what do you anticipate coming in the next decade or so in ophthalmology, especially cataract refractive side? What do you think is coming?
Yeah, so I mean, I've been really excited with the evolution in my career from, you know, really everybody just got a basic lens and we didn't think about astigmatism. We didn't think about quality of the ocular surface. We didn't think about quality of vision, actually, after cataract surgery. That wasn't really part of our mindset. And we are so refractive in our mindset with cataract surgery now that I think that's just going to keep evolving. And I'm very excited for having a truly accommodative lens, a lens that will allow us to really see a smooth transition from distance to really near that we want, that high-powered near that we're looking for. And I really hope that we have that before I need cataract surgery. So that's a little self-serving. But I also am excited because I think when we have that with a non-diffractive technology where we're going to not be so worried about, you know, at least early disease in patients, we're really going to be able to take it to the next level. So I'm excited for that. I'm excited for a better predictability with our biometry and our nomograms. AI, I think, is going to play a big role in that, where we're just going to be much, much better at deciding which technology fits a patient, which lens power they need, and what their needs are going to be, you know, over the future. And, you know, I think that even being able to do things that change that refractive outcome and continue to provide best quality of vision over the lifetime of the patient, that's going to change as well. Maybe we'll be focusing a little bit more on what happens in the vitreous. I think that's likely. I think that we may be able to do some adjustability over time and not just fixed adjustability that happens immediately postoperatively, but maybe adjustability even further down the road. So I think those are the kinds of things I'm super excited about.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, ability to change the lens power or adjust it as you age, as you get older and develop more against the rule. And if you can go back and, like I was talking to Randy Olson about this from Utah, about, yeah, refractive index shaping of any existing lens. And you can keep kind of tuning it up in perpetuity so the patient can have fantastic vision for the entirety of his or her life.
Yeah. No, I think that that's sort of the holy grail, right? To always be able to provide the best optical system for the patient's current needs so that we can continually provide, you know, that best quality of vision. And hopefully we'll get there. I think we will, actually.
I think so, too. I think there are a lot of different horses in the race, which I think is the more the better. And hopefully not only one, but I think hopefully multiple horses will win that race and we'll have so many great options available to us.
You know, I think actually the other thing that I'm excited about, which I've been fortunate to be involved in, which I didn't really ever want to be involved in glaucoma care, to be honest. That was not part of the cataract refractive plan. But I've been really, really excited to be a part of the MIGS journey. And I was an early investigator with Ivantis, with Hydrus. I've been part of the investigative team and research efforts with Glaukos and with other new technologies in the MIGS space. And, you know, I just think that that is such a benefit and such a wonderful thing that we can offer as a holistic treatment for our cataract patients that not only helps them to prevent them from getting to more serious with more serious complications, surgeries like trabs and tubes, but it improves the ocular surface when we can get patients off of topical drops.
Sure.
So I've been very excited about that. I think there's so much in the pipeline right now. And, you know, not really where I thought I would be, not on my radar in those early days, but a really exciting place to be as we provide better care for our patients.
Well, I think you're right. It's a neat time to be in ophthalmology, and I think it's the golden years are still in front of us. So they're coming. Now, tell me about your career path. Now you're obviously a very busy surgeon. You do a tremendous volume of surgery, but how did you get kind of ramped up and, like, after your training? You don't just land where you are today. How do you evolve that?
So I think I had a little bit of a different path because remember that brother I told you about who's an optometrist? Well, he practiced in a pretty large network. It was, you know, large at the time. It's gotten tremendously large since then. But a network of optometric practices in Indiana. And I went into practice with him and was able to do a pretty good volume even coming right out of training. So I kind of hit the ground running, which can be exciting. It can be really intimidating since I didn't really have, you know, that backup we sometimes have when you're early in your career. Sure. And you're still feeling like, gosh, it's all on me now. And I had the opportunity to pretty much do a wide range of things, as many of us do right when we come out of training. I did lids and retinal lasers and, you know, all kinds of strabismus and, you know, just a little bit of everything. So I got a lot of surgical experience pretty quickly. And then that helped me to get to a point where I could really refine it to the things that excited and interested me the most. So sure. I think in some ways that was just, it was a lucky way to start. And after about 10 years in that situation, I needed to get back to the ocean and back to marine biology, at least as a hobby. So we ended up back in Florida, where we've been ever since.
Oh, fantastic. So you tell us about your position in Florida.
Yeah, so I'm in a multi-specialty practice on the west coast of Florida in the Cataract Highway. So we have a lot of volume here. Our location, we have two surgery centers and we have seven clinic sites. And as I mentioned, it's multi-specialty. We have all of the subspecialties except for pediatrics, because I do live in a very old demographic. Right. And we don't have neurology, just because that's a little bit tough everywhere, I think, to fully cover. And we did partner with private equity about 5.5 years ago. So I'm also the chief medical officer for our private equity group, iHealth America. We have multiple locations in South Carolina, now Georgia, and Florida. So we're very regional in our footprint.
Fantastic. A lot of younger ophthalmologists always ask about what's it like before and after private equity becomes involved. And you obviously have firsthand knowledge. I certainly don't. I'm still a boutique, you know, physician-owned practice. Tell us about that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so private equity, you know, there's a lot of different reasons why that's the pathway that owners will take. You know, sometimes it's because they're looking to transition out of their practice, and that might be a nice way to do that. Or they just don't know with certainty what's going to happen in the future. Or maybe they're, you know, as unwilling maybe in the future to do a lot of personal guarantees, and they're looking for more financial backing so that they can expand in ways they wanted to expand. So everybody has their different reason why they may have gone that route. But it's you know, it's been really very good for us in the fact that we were able to open that second ASC. We have been able to acquire more practices and increase our footprint and collaborate with other practitioners in other places where we learn from them and they learn from us. So it's been good. You know, I at the same time, I will say it's not for everybody. So if you are in a practice where you like being able to make very quick decisions that maybe don't always have an immediate ROI, you know, return on investment. Sure. So maybe you want to change your phaco platform. Well, you know, maybe there's not an immediate way to show that that's going to result in, you know, more revenue for the practice. In fact, you might have a capital outlay for that. But right. You know that that new technology might result in either better outcomes or more efficient surgery or something. Those decisions become a little bit more complex. So if you like being in charge of every decision like that, you might not want to move into a place where you have, you know, a little more administrative oversight for some of those things. So I don't like to say that it's for everybody, but I would say that for the people who really think about it and know their why for going into it, it can be a very good thing for them as well.
So it's all a balance, and just figure out what works for you and decide if that's the right fit.
Yep. And you know, I mean, sometimes people, I like to do a lot of mentoring too of our younger colleagues, and I do get this question a lot, and especially for people who are just coming out of training and they don't know, you know, should I join a private equity group? Should I join a, you know, a private practice? Should I put my own shingle out and start there? And, you know, again, it's a very personal thing. You may not make the right decision for where you want to be or the type of practice you want to be in. Or, you know, you may not have enough information to really understand, even in yourself, what makes you tick more, you know? But the good news is none of these decisions are forever. You can always decide, hey, I tried this thing out. That really wasn't for me, or I found it limiting in this area, or I found it uncertain in this other area, and I just really want to change that dynamic. And you can always change that. So I would say, you know, moving forward is the key. You know, sometimes we get frozen and stuck with this indecision. So I'm proud of our young colleagues who decide to just go out there and start their own thing. Or there's lots that later in their career say, you know what, I was in a bigger group setting, now I want to do my own thing. I think that's brave and cool and great and adventurous and keeps you nimble, as we said, but maybe in a business way. Or it's great to make a different decision where you go, you know what, I'm so sick and tired of being the person hiring people, firing people, figuring out new regulations, working with the insurance companies, having to deal with a call center, marketing, million other hats that we don't really think about when we're employed, but we definitely know about when we're an owner. And I want somebody else to take all that. I just want to cut it down to seeing patients and providing care. And then maybe a switch from doing all those other things to having somebody else or a structure and infrastructure that helps you with that is a good thing. So just realize you can change along the way as you learn. Like what I tell my teenagers is you right now are trying to invent the person you want to be. Like think about yourself. Who is that person that you want to be in 5 or 10 years? And then keep moving towards that. Try to create that person. And I was having this conversation with my 16-year-old the other day, and I said, you know, I'm still doing that. I'm still figuring out who I want to be.
I'm not 100% certain yet either.
No, I'm like, you know, you see me right now trying to like work out and be a little more fit because I realize I'm getting older. I still have so many things I want to do. A lot of those are active things. And if I keep going on this pathway I have been going on, I'm not going to be able physically to do the things I want to do. So I'm reinventing myself now. I'm trying to stay, you know, fit enough that I can do the things I want to do in the future. And I'm thinking about that me 5 years from now, 10 years from now, that I want to be and trying to make steps to get there. And I think we just keep doing that. We keep reinventing ourselves. So
it sounds like you, like me, have found a little bit more balance, you know, after the kind of the, in the middle of the career as opposed to the beginning of the career.
Yeah, I think we get wiser, right? I mean, there's a lot of ways I would like to go back to my 20s as far as energy, you know, and, you know, ability to do all these things and be stronger or whatever. But boy, if I had to give up the wisdom from what I learned along the way, I don't think that's a good swap. So the wisdom's pretty important, right?
Right. And I can attest, though, on the physical part of it, I can bench press the same now as I did in med school 25 years ago. So you can certainly get back. It took me 2 years to get back there, but I promise you can do it.
I'm working on it. I'm working on it. It's not there yet, but I'm taking the steps. you're an inspiration, Uday.
Oh, you're too sweet. That you're very kind. Tell us about your leadership role. So obviously we just announced at the beginning of this, you're going to be ASCRS secretary and then a couple years down the road, be president, president-elect, all that. Tell us about how you got involved in all this and why that's important to you.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that, you know, there's different philosophies, again, as you're trying to figure out who you are. And one of my philosophies has been to try to leave things better than I found them. So part of the reason that part of the reason why you dedicate so much time as you do to mentoring and to education is because you're trying to elevate ophthalmology and you're trying to help everybody to do like a better job and all of that. And that's been important to me too, you know, to try to leave things better than I found them. And as you move through your career and you find the ways that are rewarding to you to do that, you know, there will be a point where you start having bigger and bigger roles as you become more and more involved. And so I had the pleasure of being, you know, the Outpatient Ophthalmic Surgery Society president and, you know, doing some leadership things with AAO, doing some leadership things with ASCRS, and as you mentioned, the secretary role. And that'll be a 6-year commitment, actually, on the executive board. So I'll be around for a while doing those kinds of things. But that's been really rewarding. I feel like it expands maybe some of the ways that I can give back because I feel like the profession's given a lot to me. Way that I can give back and maybe have a little bit bigger influence, hopefully in a positive way.
Oh, I think that's great points. I mean, that's nice. I like the thought of leaving it better than I found it. So kind of leaving an improvement for everyone. I love it. It's fantastic. Now, how do other people, other ophthalmologists get involved with this? I mean, part of the thing is, as you know, the ASCRS was changed their bylaws last year at the meeting in Washington, D.C., where before that, apparently, I may not be 100% right, but apparently there were supposed to be elections, but there weren't. And then as of last year now, it's just kind of internally nominated and selected. How then? That seems kind of odd. How do you get a person who's an outsider? How do they get involved?
Such a good question. I'm so glad to have the opportunity to talk about that, because really it's sort of like, it's very parallel, I think, to the question I'm often asked about, how do you get involved with industry and how do you get involved with our national organizations as well? And it's really by, number one, stating that you're interested. So just keep telling people what excites you about ophthalmology, where you're interested in being involved. Do you want to, you know, learn more about government relationships and how we advocate for ophthalmology? Do you want to be on the education side and maybe be involved in one of the clinical committees? Do you want to be involved in planning meetings? You know, there's many, many roles that you can take in different organizations that will then lead to more and more leadership roles. But you can't wait for somebody to come and ask you. You have to start talking to people and saying, look, I'm super interested in being a bigger part of this. And once you do that, believe me, as soon as you're the person who says, yes, I will do the work, and when you're asked to do something, you do the work, we're always looking for people that are reliable that way, that are passionate that way, that really care about giving back and being involved. And as you make those first steps, like I mentioned, and become more and more an integral part of those different groups or different parts of the different organizations, people will recognize that and you will move up in leadership that way. So really, and for this pathway that I'm on, the secretary to treasurer, vice president, president, it's a long pathway. That really is because I then stepped into some of those leadership positions after being on committees for a while. And that's what I would say. You know, if this is something you think you'd like to be involved in, go to the leaders of the different clinical committees, cataract clinical committee, glaucoma, refractive, even the YES committee, which is the folks that are either in training or in the first 5 years of their practice, and say, look, I am interested in being involved. I want to do some work for the academy or do some work for ASCRS. And I'm just super excited about what we do in our profession, and I want to be an integral part of that. You will definitely find takers. We are always looking for committed people, and that will be a pathway to more leadership.
Oh, that's some fantastic advice. What other great pearls do you have for the young ophthalmologists listening to this podcast? Because I think now we hit mid-career. Hopefully I've got another 20 years left in my career. But there are things that we realize, like, whoa, I kind of was doing things the wrong way. I wish I could tell my 30-something-year-old self this.
Yeah, so first, I would like to say, just realize that you have a perspective that's valuable. I think one of the things we sometimes do is, you know, a lot of people, they'll be like, I just want to get involved. But as soon as they're on a clinical committee, say, or they're on a medical advisory board, or an ad board, you know, for a company or wherever, they are a little shy, maybe a little reticent, a little imposter syndrome about their role there. They don't really know if they have something to contribute, or they don't feel like maybe they have something to contribute. And the first thing I would say is, yes, you do. Everybody has a unique perspective, and especially a younger ophthalmologist perspective. That is information that everybody wants to know, because that's the future of ophthalmology.
Right.
So you not only have a unique perspective, you have a critically important perspective, and just speak up. And then the second thing is, I would say, is be honest. You know, nobody really wants to hear you just say what you think they want you to say all the time. They want to hear your honest opinion. And so not only is it unique and it's important, but it is something that you should really share as a truth that you have in your, you know, your vision or your experience, and be honest about it. You don't have to always be agreeing with everybody. That's not actually as useful as having some disagreeing perspectives with others that you hear, even if it's somebody you respect and, you know, they're older and you feel like maybe they have more experience to speak from. You still have an important thing to say, an important perspective to share.
So speak your mind, speak from the heart, just be you. Don't be shy about it.
Absolutely. And then another point would be, don't be shy to talk to people that you see that maybe you want to have them as a mentor or you want to hear their perspective. I think the other thing we sometimes do, and I don't know about you, but when I was early in my career, I didn't reach out to people that would have been mentors to me because I definitely felt like they would not want to hear from me and that I would be bugging them. We didn't have as many mechanisms, I feel like, to get involved and to connect like we do now, like YoungMD Connect, great organization for our younger colleagues. But take advantage of those and realize that it energizes, I was going to say the old folks, but the legacy doctors. I like that word better, legacy doctors. But it energizes everybody to see enthusiasm, to see, you know, your perspective, like where you are, what are your questions? How can I, it's kind of flattering, you know, for somebody to say, hey, I think you might have, you know, something to share with me that would help me on my pathway. So I feel like most of us, if not all of us, are very receptive to your questions, to reaching out, to you wanting to find out more or to hear, you know, your perspective and your questions and then share our experience with that. So it's welcome. And don't feel shy about reaching out.
I think that's a great point. Yeah, in fact, every email I get, every DM on Instagram, every YouTube comment, or every way people contact me, I reply.
Yeah.
If I didn't reply, I didn't get your message.
Because it's exciting to see that somebody is engaging with you, right? And I don't know. I think it's actually cool that somebody would reach out and say, hey, I saw something you did or what your pathway is, and I want to learn from you. And I think most of us feel that way, that it's not a burden. It's actually something that energizes us.
Right. We have such a small field, right? We're training like 460 new ophthalmologists per year, period. That's the total number of residency spots. So it's like we're small beings. it's a small community. I think that's neat.
Mm-hmm. But, yeah, absolutely.
That's fantastic. Well, I look forward to seeing more of you, and certainly I love learning from your surgical videos, and maybe we get another submission for you for Cataract Coach or some other interesting case you've had. But certainly, again, I'll link it below, the belt loop technique. It's something you just need to know. You're going to find so much use for it in your clinical practice. I've used it a number of times already, and I just thought, wow, this is brilliant. I'm going to now upgrade. I've learned from you 6.0. And I can use a 30-gauge long one, but just the regular one. I don't need the thin wall ones anymore. So I was listening.
Absolutely.
But no, we'd love to see more videos from you. I certainly really appreciate you taking the time to do our interview. And thank you again.
Oh, no. Thank you so much. And I just want, on behalf of all of us in ophthalmology, to thank you for your dedication to educating us all. Because now tell me exactly what number you're on with Cataract Coach.
Well, we all learn together is the key. I mean, I learn as much as I put out there. But in October, we'll hit video or post number 2,000. So every day for 2,000 days in a row.
That's incredible. That is unbelievable. So,
you're too sweet. My thought behind it was, if I can influence, let's say, 1,000 ophthalmologists, and they each do 1,000 cases a year, if I can teach them something, that's 1,000,000 patients.
Oh, I'm telling you, that's...
Right? Now take a step back. There are 55,000 subscribers so far and 20 million views. So she's the reach is out there.
Like when I'm saying leave things better than you found them and making your impact exponentially greater, you have done that with the platform that just expands everything. And not only that, it's not just your experience, but you've allowed us to share our experience in a much more effective way than we would have otherwise. So again, thanks.
Oh, thank you.
You're the best.
And now that you're the ACRS secretary, I can give like a subtle hint, like hint, educator award.
no kidding. I would assume that you had already had that.
No, I've had the first winner of the award, Tom Oding, has been kind enough to nominate me every year since after he got his award. But I'm hopeful. I'm like the guy who never quite wins the Oscar but gets nominated. So
I'm going to tell you, you are that there is nobody I can think of that deserves it more. So, yeah,
you're too sweet.
I'm rooting for you, but I know I don't need to. There's 55,000 other people and 1,000,000 downloads that are rooting for you, too.
Well, 20 million, but who's counting?
20 million. 20 million.
20 million views. But thank you again, and I look forward to another video from you. I appreciate it.
All right. Thanks so much, Uday.
Thanks for enjoying that podcast with me. And remember, please subscribe to the podcast and tell your friends about it. Leave a comment here. Let me know who you'd like as a future guest. Because remember, we've got a new podcast coming every single week. We'll catch you next time.